You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Side by side, their faces blurred, the Earl and Countess lie in stone. Their proper habits vaguely shown as jointed armour, stiffened pleat, and that faint hint of the absurd, the little docks under their feet. Such plainness of the pre-Baroque hardly involves the eye until it meets his left-hand gauntlet, still clasped empty in the other. And one sees with a sharp, tender shock his hand withdrawn, holding her hand. They would not think to lie so long, such faithfulness in effigy was just a detail friends would see, a sculptor's sweet commissioned grace thrown off in helping to prolong the Latin names around the base. They would not guess how early in their supine stationary voyage the air would change to soundless damage, turn the old tenantry away. How soon succeeding eyes begin to look, not read. Rigidly they persisted, linked through length and breadth of time. Snow fell, undated. Light each summer thronged the glass. A bright litter of bird calls strewed the same bone-riddled ground. And up the paths the endless, altered people came. Washing at their identity, now helpless in the hollow of an unarmorial age, a trough of smoke in slow suspended skeins above their scrap of history, only an attitude remains. Time has transfigured them into untruth. The stone fidelity they hardly meant has come to be their final blazon, and to prove our almost instinct almost true, what will survive of us is love.
When you visit many places of worship around the world, it's easy for us Unitarians to be struck by the sheer quantity and quality of artworks that adorn them. Some of the most gorgeous and accomplished art is in worship spaces, painting, statuary, tapestry, stained glass, work of human hands that are lovely in their own right. Church and temple iconography often represents the people of that tradition's story. Rich patrons like the Earl and his wife in that poem. historical characters, sometimes notable clergy, saints, even deities. Indeed, in Orthodox traditions, East and West, icons themselves are often venerated, prayed to, decorated, kissed, danced to, offered gifts of food, drink, incense, even cash money, as if they could reach down and grab these offerings. That sort of veneration may seem a little primitive to us. After all, the statue or painting isn't actually the thing it represents, is it? But when you compare these icon-rich places with worship spaces in our own nonconformist tradition, you'll see a big difference. Like the Quaker meeting houses, congregational churches, and other late Protestant worship spaces, ours, even contemporary ones, tend to be, well, rather plain, largely free of iconography, bare, stripped down, one might almost say cleansed, to the point of clinical sterility. Cleansed of what, exactly? Are we anti-art Philistines? Are religious icons a kind of distraction from the purpose of being in such places? Like when all you want in a pub is a place to drink with friends, but there are screens everywhere with every kind of sporting code going on. Distraction. Or was it that we took seriously the second commandment that we shouldn't make any graven image because any attempt to picture the infinite and eternal was bound to be a projection of us and our human limitations, like, oh, a male-gendered god is a projection of patriarchal cultures. Or if you want to look away from the screen and look back to the stained glass, on the right, Scandinavian hipster Jesus on the right. Scandinavian hipster Jesus is a projection of the racial preferences of our 19th century British colonial colonists. Or is there some more reasonable fear at work here? Is there some real moral danger in seductively lavish iconography? Well, what our nonconformist forebears feared was not the icons themselves, but another I word, idolatry. Now, an idol is something you worship, something that's raised to worth, that is what worship means, worth-ship, raised to worth, for itself, in itself, it's taken literally, it's something looked adoringly at. For example, those holy relics that people go and see. An icon, on the other hand, is an object that is entirely symbolic, something you look through like a lens to the abstract, inexpressible things it stands in for. For example, our flaming chalice. Icons, it was feared, might lead to idolatry in people less, well, capable of abstract thought, and thus lead to worshiping what's not really worthy. A bit patronizing, really, this rejection of icons. Maybe we can cultivate the wisdom to look at how we look at things. Our lack of iconography so comes from Reformation history. It was Calvin, John Calvin, who identified the human heart as an idol factory. Not an idol factory, like a factory that's closed, an idol factory. He said that in this fallen world, we are constantly, and he's not wrong in this, we are constantly seeking tangible things to worship and serve, even though we are always and everywhere in the presence of the infinite and eternal. Calvin was probably thinking of a passage from the letters of John. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in them. For everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, comes not from the Father, but from the world. So our sparse, unadorned spaces are a legacy of a theology. But idolatry is not really to do with old superstitious religion. It's not even a religious issue. Calvin was right in that idolatry is a perennial human issue. Because we do degrade ourselves when we lift up to ultimate worth unworthy things. If you think about this, you will see that there's some truth in this. Everybody here, every one of you, worships, that is, raises to worth, something that guides and motivates your highest thoughts, your noblest aspirations, your deepest feelings. It could be, I don't know, wisdom or compassion or justice. Of course, we get to choose what to raise to worth, but what we choose to worship must clearly matter because it is so contested. Our culture, our worldly culture, encourages us and instructs us to venerate and serve things that can enslave us, that can eat us alive, in fact. Those who worship power, for example, will always feel themselves weak and strive to dominate others. Those who worship physical attractiveness will always be consumed with a losing race against natural laws of time and gravity. If you worship wealth, you will never, ever feel you have enough financial security. Worship popularity, and you will never have enough friends, followers, fans, and will go to greater and greater lengths to attract them. I was going to put up some of the lengths that Kim Kardashian has gone to attract more fans and followers, but this is a family show. Worship the intellect, and you will secretly feel stupid and always be looking for other people's mistakes. Worship any human institution, and it will betray you at some point. For when was there ever a human institution worthy of the free individual human spirits in it? Maybe the shiny things of this world are a trap, but when our hearts are in a place where we can see more clearly, we can see through to what is truly worthy. Our second hymn puts it really beautifully, when our heart is in a holy place. Please stand as you're able.
When our heart is in...
Unitarianism at its best is inherently progressive. It is about building a better, freer religion by building better, freer individuals. But the longer I'm a Unitarian, that's 25 years now, the more I'm struck by a deep irony. Nonconformity is not automatically freeing. In fact, nonconformity can be a pretty conservative habit. Reactionary, maybe. The puritanical sparseness of our churches bespeaks a fear of idols more than a love of worthy things, I think. But our lack of iconography has not and does not make us free of idolatry, for our own Unitarian hearts, bound as they must be to the things of this world, still churn out our own idols, just our Unitarian ones are a different kind. And Unitarians will never be the truly free people we imagine and proclaim ourselves to be until we are freed from certain idolatries that are particular to us. What are some examples, Rob? I'm glad you asked. Here are a few that are common in my wide, though not fully comprehensive, experience of churches in the EU, the US, the UK, and Australia, New Zealand. First, the idolatry of the church building. These aging arcs of our collective history are killing many of our overseas churches. Cities and demographics change around them, time wears them down, and they become like ill-curated museums or mausoleums festooned with monuments to the unknowable dead, like the Duke or the Earl in the poem. Does only the building's familiarity, location, and convenience call us together? Why do you go to that church? It's in my neighborhood, man. Why do you go to that church? It's on my bus route. A church is an exoskeletal life form like bivalves and mollusks. Those that get stuck in their shells die. Shells are shells because they're exchangeable. Just as many houses can be your home, the church is not the building. The church is what caused the building to be built. I'm going to say that again. The church is not the building. The church is what caused the building to be built. What is that thing that caused it to be built? Well, just because you can't see what it is doesn't mean there's nothing there. Clearly something formed this shell. By the way, The ministries of Jesus and Buddha were entirely nomadic, movable feasts, and they didn't do so badly. Second Unitarian idolatry is the idolatry of ye great and famous Unitarians of ye past. We have a bad habit of claiming accomplished historical figures as adherents. Google famous UUs and you'll see. Often, the link is actually tenuous at best. In the name of the Joseph Priestley and the Tim Berners-Lee and the holy Bertrand Russell, amen. This Unitarian idolatry is especially seductive and nasty because it is so obviously self-loathing. This is the low self-esteem of the stage mother, the name dropper, the groupie, the fanboy, the stereotypical mom who boasts about my son the doctor. Borrowed status derived outside oneself is the hallmark of the truly tragic. To bask in the reflected glory of famous past Unitarians lets us off the hook of accomplishing anything original, brave, or meaningful ourselves in the present. The answer to this low self-esteem is not idolizing past fame, but in creating healthy self-love in the here and now by maybe taking the achievements of great Unitarians seriously enough to emulate them ourselves. Instead, it's like evangelical Christians shouting about how much they love Jesus while they judge others, swindle their neighbor, and hate on anybody different from them. Love Jesus? Great. Go and do likewise. Love our famous Unitarian forebears? Emulate them. And finally, and this one cuts a little close to home, beloved reverend ministers who, like the sun, radiate light and warmth on all you lesser mortals. Because our churches aren't Bible-centered or Christ-centered, there is no solid core text, doctrine, or human figure to latch onto. Because of that, our preaching tradition, our Unitarian preaching tradition, to be authentic, tends to be the most autobiographical. And thus, our ministry, the more inclined to personality cult, or its evil twin, character assassination. So the minister, you see, becomes a stand-in for the God we seek to adore or the God we want to be revenged upon, depending on your psychology. I have heard congregants speak adoringly about Minister X's story about the starfish on the beach, or what Minister Y said about you are God's hands, you are God's eyes, you are God's feet, when neither of those stories were created by the ministers who are credited for them. Ministers mostly curate and channel the work of others. Because our ministers preach from their own life and experience, there tends to be this mythology of the creative genius around us. But when you think about it, nobody creates something out of nothing. Or rather, creating something out of nothing is what only gods do. Ministers aren't gods or the Messiah. We're just very naughty boys and girls just like you. We're not whiter than white, morally pure. We're not creative mystics, and the light of God doesn't especially shine through me, flattering though that is to hear, any more or less than that light can shine through each of you. Ministers are skilled workers in a service industry. We are skilled workers in a service industry, cottage industry. A focused and flexible range of knowledge, a narrow but nimble skill set, and some talent I was born with, but that's it. And any one of you or anyone out there has as much capacity for this work. The only difference is that we commit to doing this. And if we're lucky not to be thrown under the bus, to do it repeatedly enough to develop a facility for it. To expect anything other than another flawed human in this role is not just unreasonable from a workplace standpoint, it's idolatrous. These common Unitarian idolatries, church buildings and their trappings, famous forebears, and people-pleasing ministers, aren't meant to be lifted to worth in themselves. But our human hearts hunger for something solid to latch onto and venerate. Letting that hunger drive you is idolatry, and idolizing anything or anyone can only distract or disempower or enslave you. All idols are false. The Unitarian movement tries to build a truer, better religion out of the broken shards of the old. So, what if we disenthralled ourselves from these false idols and looked on them as the icons they truly are, not as things to be looked up to, but things to be seen through? Not looked up to, but seen through. For example, what if we saw our buildings not as museum dioramas to maintain and retrofit at great expense, but seen through as the temporary dwellings for the living organism within it? What if we saw through our famous forebearers, not as something to brag status about, but role models, seen through as role models of courage and faith and wisdom to emulate? What if we saw through even our most beloved ministers to perceive, as the Quakers put it, that of the light of God in anyone? And if we did, we might love ourselves a little better. We might rediscover the witness of our Unitarian faith, and we might become the idol-free zone we once strove to be, and the presence of the infinite and eternal might be allowed to shine through these icons and be perceived by truly free hearts and minds. Don't get me wrong, I love religious iconography. I wish we had more of it. I also wish we could rely on our wiser discernment to see the way we see things. So if we look at gorgeous sacred iconography and swoon at the majesty and awe that arises in us, if we swell with pride when we tell others Unitarians worked to end slavery and worked to rescue refugees from Nazism, if we are captivated by inspired preaching or touched by loving pastoral kindness, always remember that the Heisenberg principle is at work. We only see how things are when we are around them. So we bring a lot to the seeing. The light that we feel shines on us from anything we lift up is in part a reflected light. Like the moon last night, a reflection of our own inner light, that of the divine in each of us, rising from our depths and shining out and reflecting. And the poem we heard earlier captures perfectly this principle. It tells us much more about the poet, the seer, than the iconic figures on the tomb. Philip Larkin, famously cranky, forever single, solitary, and unbeloved, could see in the icon's stony gesture an enduring love he could never find but could feel and be drawn toward. He looked through what many could have stupidly venerated, passed by as just a piece of boring art history, or condemned as a sign of a class system of an armorial age, and he saw through it to that which truly endures and deserves worship. Love, which transcends time. If you want to practice seeing through icons and thus avoid idolatry, you might look no further than our stained glass windows, seeing not so much the symbolic figures on the surface, but seeing through them the far worthier thing which makes such glass truly wonderful and without which it can't work. The pure light beyond that illuminates it, the radiance that is everywhere and is nowhere and is endless. Seeing through the surface of this world to that which animates it is what icons are truly for. Amen.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.